My name's John. I'm an alcoholic. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Ringwood AA and Al-Anon Events Committee, I would like to welcome all of you here today and thank you all for making this event possible. I would also like to thank Burgate School for allowing us the opportunity to hold this event here and remind everyone that this school is a no-smoking venue. If you wish to smoke, you need to go outside the gate, okay, outside the front. And thanks everyone who was involved in service for making this event possible today. May I also ask that if anyone is interested in getting involved with these speaker events, to please see one of the committee members. Could the committee members stand up and make themselves known, please? Hands up. There's one over the back. Kev over the back. Okay. Right. Also, I would like to add that the next speaker events to be held are scheduled for the 2nd and 3rd of January. Polly Pistol and Dave Pistol will be sharing at these events. Something to look forward to after Christmas. Tickets are available in the foyer or off the committee members. Get those hands up. Right, I'm now going to hand the meeting over to Roy, who is your chairman this evening. Thanks very much. One last thing before you come up, Roy.
Well, thank you, John. That's a first. I've never been a chairman before. Well, good evening, everybody. My name is Roy, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Roy.
Hi. And can we please have a few moments' silence to remember the still suffering alcoholic inside and outside of our rooms? Thank you. I'd now like to read our anonymity statement, which is our tradition 11. There may be some here who are not familiar with our tradition of personal anonymity at the public level, which states that our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion, and we always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. Thus, we respectfully ask you that no AA speaker or indeed any AA member be identified by full name or photograph in published or broadcast reports of our meetings. The assurance of anonymity is essential in our effort to help other problem drinkers who may wish to share our recovery program with us. And our tradition of anonymity reminds us that AA principles come before personalities. And I've asked Teresa this evening, please, to read our preamble.
Thank you, Roy. My name is Teresa. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's a real privilege, honour and a great pleasure to introduce our speaker to the group this evening, a man who's devoted decades to helping alcoholics achieve sobriety. And indeed, I understand that his full-time, or maybe his night-time, job is as director still of the Midnight Mission in his hometown. And probably along with many of others in this room tonight, he certainly helped me enormously in my early recovery, which was 5 years ago. This through the medium of cassette tapes, borrowed, on a cassette player, borrowed, and subsequently I was able to graduate to CDs, initially on a borrowed CD player. So it gives me very, very great pleasure to introduce Clancy I from Los Angeles, California.
My name is Clancy Immerslund, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here this afternoon, morning, evening. What the hell is that? I don't know. Sometime in New Forest. I just sent my children some postcards from here. All I could find was pictures of something called New Forest. I never heard of it. I told them I spent the entire day looking for Robin Hood, but I guess he was in the Old Forest. But anyway, I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to welcome the people who have birthdays today. And the gentleman who had 35 years back there. Somebody. 35? Oh, 25. Okay. That's too new for me. I've been fortunate to be sober a long time. And, of course, what you want to keep remembering when you keep saying how long you've been sober, because it is my belief that someday AA will have a pension plan. And I want to get credit for every damn day I got here. But I know we have some new people here tonight. I met them before the meeting. And I've been spending the last few years spending a lot of time because as I think back of the years I spent in and out of AA, year after year after year, I came to AA as a relatively high-bottom AA group, alcoholic, and then I became a medium-bottom alcoholic. And the last day I drank, two big guys threw me out of a skid row mission and said, "Don't ever come back here, you bum." And I just had my teeth kicked out in jail, so I wasn't hitting those consonants quite as clearly as I might have. But I remember saying, "But I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of a big university. Ads that I wrote were running this very week in national magazines. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements." But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. You know, but I had no idea that AA could ever work for me, and I'm sure that's what happens to people who have difficulty working here and staying here. And the major problem always seems to be, I think the thing that keeps more people out of AA than anything I know, at least the people I know, are the first three steps of AA. They're wonderful steps, and they're great steps, but they keep people out. Because they want you to admit you're an alcoholic, apparently. They want you to return to God, apparently. They want you to turn your life over to God. And if God doesn't like you, that isn't a good deal. I heard a guy say one time, "Whatever I had no place to stay, I turned my life over to God. And you want to know what? I still didn't have any place to stay." And I come from a small town up in a place called Wisconsin, which is up by Canada in the United States. And I was raised in a very strict Norwegian Lutheran ethic. I don't know if any of you have Norwegian Lutherans here. They used to come here several hundred years ago, visit. What do we do today? Let's go down to England and burn convents. Come on. But I come with a strong Norwegian Lutheran ethic, and it's very strict. They always think, you hear in AA all the time, people whining about their Catholics, that they're so strict. In the Norwegian Lutheran Church, our dropouts become Catholic priests. I mean, that's just for quitters. Incidentally, before I forget, I do want to forget. I want to thank Frank Palomera for being such a good host, and his faithful daughter, Pamela, who has been, they've been very gracious. I've known Frank for many, many years, and he's always been very kind and gracious. And I want to greet especially some friends from Scotland and Ireland back there who sit in the back corner judging all the English. Bad cess to ye. We'll win them over someday. But I grew up in very strict, and I did very well. I seemed to function. I went to church. I was converted. Went to church and did all the things. And I was a straight-A student in school, and I could read fast, so they shoved me ahead in school a year and a half when I was young. And I did very well. And when I was 11 or so, my parents got divorced, which doesn't seem like much. Everybody gets divorced. But if you can imagine the life I had at 11 years old, I never had heard of a divorce because nobody in our church ever had one. Nobody in our family ever had one. And that made me unhappy. But they explained it to me, and I understood it, but I didn't like it. And I look back and think about that now. Without being any motive to do it, I immediately did the worst thing that people can do, as a result, children can do. I began playing my mother against my father to avoid discipline. And I could fool him. My mother would give me hell, I'd run to my father and tell him stories about her. And when my father gave me hell, I'd run to my mother and tell her stories about him. And they both gave me hell, I'd run to my grandma. And I fooled him again and again and again. By the time I was 15, I was flunking out of school. I had no friends left. I'd become a cynical, sarcastic little snot, the worst type of people that there are. And I think I was starting to run with really bad kids. And I started to think I'm on the way to the reform. I look back, I think I was on my way to the penitentiary. And what saved my life was the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. And that was the first thing I could remember for a long time that held my attention off of me briefly. And then one day, a kid in our high school enlisted in the Marine Corps and came home dressed in a Marine Corps uniform. He was tall and dressed blues. It just looked wonderful. And the girls all went, ah. And I thought, that's what I need. I forgot I was short and had a face full of pimples. I just thought, that's what I'd... And so I said, how'd you do that? He said, I went to San Francisco and enlisted. So I thought, that's what I'll do. I'll go to San Francisco and enlist. And it was only about 2,000 miles. And I didn't know how big it was. I looked at a map in the school library. You go through a yellow state and a blue state and a green state. That should be fun. And I got some money to go to northern part of the state to visit my aunt for my mother. And she packed my little bag. And I went up. And a guy gave me a ride to Minneapolis, which was 100 miles away, a big city, comparatively. And then I was going to hitchhike from there. I'd never hitchhiked before. I didn't know what to do. I said, how do you hitchhike? I said, you just stand in the corner and smile. So I took my little bag and I stood in the corner. And the car stopped. He says, where are you going? I said, San Francisco. He said, so am I. Hop in. And away we went. Turned out he was in the Navy going back to his ship. And he drove me all the way across the United States. I didn't even think anything about it. I thought, when you hitchhike, you tell people where you want to go and they take you there. That's what I know. We'd stop at night and he'd buy me a place to sleep. There were no motels, but there were trailer courts and you could get a bed. And he bought my meals. And I prattled and prattled and prattled about how I was going to join the Marine Corps and kill Japs. And he said, you know, kid, I think you're a little small to get in the Marine Corps. And you don't really look like you're grown up and you got a face full of pimples. And you're not very good looking anyway. He said, I don't think you can get in the Marine Corps. He said, you got one chance. They got a merchant marine. All the good guys have gone in the Navy. They took you almost anybody that's breathing. And I'll show you how to get to there. And you tell them you're 16 and see what happens. So he took me all the way to San Francisco on Market Street, dropped me in front of the Coast Guard office, out of my little bag. How to be in the merchant marine? I said, fill out this application. So I filled it out. He said, you're only 15. You're only 16. You have to have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. And they were desperate. They gave me Seaman's papers right there. No training, no nothing. They sent another guy and I down to the National Maritime Union where we signed up to some union for something. They took us to the pier, the Embarcadero it's called, put us on a big ship. And that afternoon, we were on a load of torpedo warheads going to the South Pacific. And it really was fun for about an hour. Then it kind of tapered off after that. But I said, that's where the World's Fair was last year. Mm. That's Alcatraz. Mm. That's the Golden Gate Bridge. Oh. And after that, just nothing forever. Just the guy said, get to your cabin. I looked around. There's no cabins on that ship. Bunch of rooms. Turned out that's what they called a room. But I went to my room and three of the worst type of guys that any small, skinny, dumb Norwegian Lutheran people could be with were in that room. They're called men. What the hell are you supposed to be? I could see there's a little tension, so I told them a joke that I was used to go over good in English class, didn't go over good there. Why don't you get your bunk? Shut up. So I got my bunk, and I still remember that ship going around like this. And these guys start talking. And I was shocked. I mean, I had been a bad kid. I'd already broken three commandments. I didn't remember to keep the Sabbath day holy, and I didn't honor my mother and father, and I sometimes took the Lord's name in vain. But mostly I was a good kid, because the Norwegian Lutherans are trained to be that way. And they were terrible people. They start talking about dirty things, and I thought, my God, I'm in a room with sinners. I mean, big-time sinners. They've been in San Francisco for several days doing dirty things with girls, and they're just laughing and joking. I couldn't bear it. I mean, even at the age of 15, I'd had sex, but I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. And these these guys were doing it with people. Then I realized, of course, they've all got black hair. Those are the Catholics I've heard about. But I eventually got to be the ship fool, and I got along all right, and got to Pearl. And these guys, another thing they did, they all drank whiskey. And I never been in the room with a bottle of whiskey unless with these boobs. They'd drink whiskey, talk dirty. And I would just lay in my bunk and avert my head. I just couldn't stand it. And one day, one of these guys come up to me and says, "How about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort?" And he shoved that bottle in my face, and I determined, I got to get this taken care of now. So I was prepared to tell him, "Listen, you, don't put that whiskey in my face. I happen to be a Norwegian Lutheran. Perhaps you've heard of us. We're pretty good people. I promised my mother and grandmother I'd never drink whiskey, and I never will drink whiskey. Don't ever put that bottle in my face again." I was just going to tell him that. He says, "Why do you think you're mad enough?" And I heard a voice say, "God damn right." So I had my first drink of whiskey out of the first bottle I was ever close to, and I threw it up, and they laughed and ridiculed me. "Ha ha, get the bottle away from those numbers. Ha 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 ha." To this day, I don't know a feeling that's worse than public embarrassment and humiliation, where someone just pulls your covers and they can see that you're nothing. I thought later there was one thing I might have done. I'm glad I didn't think of it. They'd have thrown me overboard, but it would have been cute. I could have said, "Hey, you, lean over. Yeah. Take that." Give him one to the old eye. But all the way across the Pacific Ocean, when nobody was looking, at least once a day, I'd get one of these sea bags and take a drink of whiskey. And I'd throw it up. And I hated it. But I always had the feeling, the obsession, my first obsession, is that they treat me like a kid because I threw up that whiskey. I forgot they treat me like a kid before I threw up the whiskey. But I thought if I drank that whiskey, they'd think I was a man. And I couldn't hold it, wipe it up. We're coming into Pearl Harbor finally. God, you can still see smoke coming up from... Really, it hadn't been too long, still digging ships up. And I was, the night before my 16th birthday, and I was down there taking a drink of this slop. And it stayed down. And I couldn't breathe for a minute. Then something strange happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. It was just right. Now, you may wonder how I could remember that all the way back to World War II. I don't. I don't remember that at all. But I listened to a tape I made when I did remember it. It's all just back there somewhere in the fog. But I didn't have any big breakthrough or say, "This is wonderful." I just, when kids are in your teens, you learn. You think things you like and things you don't like and things you don't want to do and things you want to do. And that was a good thing. I couldn't explain the feeling that I had. But in retrospect, I suppose what it was, if I'd had enough brains to identify it, it was the first time I ever felt the way men looked. And it was a wonderful thing. And I didn't become a terrible old drunkard at all. I just went to Honolulu, and the next day they took me in and got me two or three bottles of beer, and I got tiddly, and they thought that was cute, and I learned to do other things. Then I went to the Aleutian Islands. The Japanese had invaded the Aleutian Islands. We had to get them out of there. And I had some sailing around, and I just tried to learn things. Then when I was 17, I went in the Navy. At the end of the war, I was in the Naval Hospital up in Northern California, and they passed around some tests. I've always been good on tests because I read a lot. And I got a test that said I was in the top 5 percentile of intelligence in the entire United States Navy. That cheered me up a little bit. But I used that to get into college because I'm still a junior in high school. And I went to college and got married in college and won some trophies for the university. Went out in the world, started off as a newspaper reporter, a sports writer. And I was supposed to be a teacher at a high school, but I got drunk once too often. They canceled me before I started. But I all got a job. Then I got a job in an advertising agency. And all these years I drank. Because drinking did something to me as it did back in that ship. It seemed nothing else that I ever found filled holes the way a few drinks does. You know, God, this looks like gin. Let's see. I don't want to smell it. It might spoil the treat. Anyway, alcohol always... I'm going to tell you something if you're new tonight. I'm going to tell you something a little surprising, maybe. Alcohol, to this day, is the best friend I've ever had. I never had a better friend than alcohol. Friends come and go. Lovers come and go. Jobs come and go. Cities come and go. But when a few drinks is just... and you can face anybody. It just makes me impervious for a little while. And the only problem I ever had is I have a tendency to drink a little too much. Or as my psychiatrist told me once upon a time, I have many times been thoughtlessly overserved. So I tried to learn to drink, and I got jobs. And my problem always was my emotions. But when I was still a young man, 22, I had been in jail a couple times, not for big sins, but for drunken behavior. And some friends said, downtown there was a new thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. Would I like to go to that? Maybe that helped me not get in jail anyway. So I went to this room where these AAs were, eight fat guys sitting around a table. The guy looked up and said, "What the hell do you want?" I thought, that's a nice introduction. I said, some people thought I might want to come here. I found out later why they had that attitude, because there was nobody in that state below 40 in AA. And I was 22, and I looked even younger. So it's like some kid 10 years old coming in now saying, "I think I'm an alcoholic." "Oh, do you? I think you have a broken nose." But I lurked around that AA meeting for a week or two, and I learned all about AA. And if you're new, it doesn't take long. You know, what's an alcoholic? It's a person whose problem is alcohol. And they come to AA and admit their problem is alcohol. Then they return to God. Then they help others and just live happily ever after. Just a totally dreary life. And so I went to AA for a while, but then my problem always were the emotions I had, the feelings. And alcohol seemed to still those emotions. My problem is I have a tendency sometimes to drink too much. That's what I got to work on. And my first guy I met there said, "Read the book, this book, Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "Okay," because I was a writer. They said, somebody told me that was a badly written book. It isn't a badly written book at all. I read it, and what it is, it's one of the world's most dull books ever written. It's just dull. So I just screw this. And many years later, when I got sober, came off Skid Row and got sober again, and my new sponsor said, "I want you to read this book." I said, "I've read that book. I don't like it." He said, "Read it again." And this time when I read it, I was astonished. I had misjudged this book. It was much duller than I remembered. I wrote things like, "Buy this product, take this action, get out of here. You read that book looking for some exaltation. If you are thorough at this stage of your development..." I need a little action. And so I went to my first AA meeting. And then I got a job in another city working in a big corporation, Fairbanks Morris, in the advertising department. And I went down there, but always happened sooner or later. I didn't know it was always going to happen, but it happened. That was the first time where they called me in and said, "Clancy, you're writing very well, but you have to be here Mondays and you smell bad when you do come in." And I thought, oh. Then I had an idea of light over my head. Because this was another town where they had an AA meeting I'd heard about. I said, "They've got this new thing, Mr. Collins, downtown called Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I got drinking overseas, and it's been a terrible problem, but they like to hear that sort of thing." I said, "Would you give me a couple of weeks to go down there and get cured, and then I'll come back to work?" And he said, "Sure, we'll pay you, Clancy. It's worth it." And so I went down to another group of idiots talking to fools. if you get sober, you'll be all right. Really? He said, you dummy. And I could see that I wasn't ever going to get well there, so I got a job in another city. And I did that again and again for the next 10 years. I got worked in cities and get in trouble, and I'd start having children. Somehow or other, in college, I'd got carried away by black hair and black flashing eyes, and I married a Catholic. And she began doing what Catholics do that I never knew about, turning out children at a remarkable rate. Just and I became a national distributor of small Catholics. Just and I remember saying to her once, can't we use birth control? She said, no. But I look back now, the times have changed so much. I don't know what I'd have done if she had said yes. Because I'd been overseas, I'd been through a major university, I'd got around quite a bit, and I'd heard the word condom once in my life. In a Navy training film, they showed this woman with big hooters and just lovely as can be, and saying, if you don't use a condom, she'll give you some terrible disease. And I thought to myself, if I could just get her, I'd take my chances on the disease. What you'd find then, you'd find kind of bad kids saying things like, I got a rubber. And even they'd be ashamed to buy it. They'd have to hire depraved people to go in. And even they'd be ashamed. They'd come and say, hey, give me a pack of cigarettes. And some rubbers. Now look how much progress we've made in the last 50-some years. In a drugstore by my house, kids come in. I guess they're grown up, but they look like kids to me. And say, give me some condoms. And some cigarettes. Get it. But I did this for years. I got up and down different cities, had to get better jobs, and became somewhat successful sometimes. Sometimes I held my emotions in check, but sooner or later they'd all get out of hand, and priest said I'd drink too much. In fact, I sometimes think about, you know, in looking back, in reading that book, my story was right there for me to read, and most people liked me, but I didn't know it. I read it, just a bunch of crap. But the first page and a half of chapter 3 is really the story of people like me's lives. And if you're new, you may wonder, what do we have in common? What do I have in common with all these people? All different sizes and shapes and colors and drinking histories and backgrounds. And one of the things that chapter delineates that we have in common is a small thing. It turns out that most alcoholics of our type have at one time or another fallen into the obsession that somehow, someday I will control and enjoy my drinking. It's as if the great illusion of all of us. We followed into the gates of insanity and death, knowing that somehow there must be a way to cure it. And that goes on to say, we all fight the term alcoholic. They want us to admit to our innermost selves we're alcoholic. I'm not really an alcoholic. It isn't the alcohol so much as all this other crap. And you fight, and then things that throw you off, like an occasional brief recovery where you think, I got it together now, followed always by a still worse relapse. Then you get to that great little sentence. God, that's a great little sentence. Reach a stage of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Remember reading it and thinking, boy, these people really get drunk. But that isn't what that means at all. That's how you feel after you get sober again. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And usually people are asking you, why the hell did you do that? And there's no answer. The correct answer is, leave me alone. Leave me alone. Get off my back. Because I don't know either. I just know that next time I'll watch it. And I quit drinking. And that's no answer, because that makes me feel bad. I go back to being that insecure, semi-frightened guy hiding behind a mask. But, you know, when I have a... That's how I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. Because you go to AA meetings, you know, people who drink and they can't stop drinking. I stopped drinking every time I got in trouble, it seemed like. But there was something important. I got... I say, no more of that. And it really works. I mean, you can stop drinking. I can all stop drinking for a couple days, 2-3 days. My problem has never been that I can't stop drinking. My problem is when I stop drinking, after about 2 or 3 days, someone seems to sneak into my bedroom in the middle of the night and put an invisible spring in my gut. Then they start to tighten it the next day. And it doesn't come out as, I need a drink. It comes out as a little restlessness, a little irritability, a little tired of my daily sermon of what I did when I got drunk last time. Watching little by little whatever color there is in my life go back to gray, the job goes back to gray, and the damn house goes back to gray, and the kids go back to gray. And I've spent thousands and thousands of dollars with psychiatrists trying to find a way to break that. And I've gone to read books, and I've joined back porches of people talking about insights to God. I've done all sorts of crap. But if you're like me, I'll tell you a secret. I'll tell you how you beat that feeling. You take a couple drinks. Oh, Jesus. And I'll watch it this time. Then pretty soon you're drunk again after a while. Then people say, see, your problem was alcohol, wasn't it? You have to say, yeah, I guess it was. But inside you just want to shriek, no, it wasn't. It's jerks like you and all the other crapheads I've got to deal business with. If you just leave me alone, I'd be all right. And start pattern again. I've done that time and time again. I've gone to jails. You know, over the years I've been in jail 32 times, which is not a record, but it's pretty good for an advertising executive, wouldn't you think, you know? I didn't do any big, like these prisoners you hear. I was in prison for 28 years. I hated being in there overnight, for God's sakes. And I've been to a nut house. I did a lot of things, but I knew that I'd go back to AA time after time. No longer that I knew it couldn't help me because I had nothing. You know, if you stop and think about it, if you're new and you wonder what AA can do for you, all you have to do is read those steps and know it can't do anything for you. What they're going to ask you to do, admit your problem is alcohol. Turn your life over to God. Make a list of all the secrets you've ever thought of in your life and tell them to some blabbermouth. Did you know I used to be married to a sheep outside of Butte, Montana? That's not my interview. I've never been to Butte, Montana. Then they ask you to become perfect, get rid of all your defects. You can be like all the people you've always hated, get little thin blue lips. And I wouldn't say that if I had a mouthful of it. Then there's a step on amends. I'm supposed to go around and make amends to people who have been screwing me for 30 years. Here's $10 for calling the police on me that time. Hope it wasn't an inconvenience. Another step on some more study if you've made some more problems. Then one of my favorites is that step on meditation. For people like me, if you want to wipe me out, you just put me in a room, dark room, for 3 hours and meditate. Make sure I have my pistol right along with me. Boom. And if you get through all that crap, what's your reward? You're going to be allowed to drive across town and let somebody puke on your shoes while you tell them about it. That doesn't fit my particular needs, I'm sorry to say, Mr. and Mrs. AA. I have different needs. I think the next doctor will help me. I wish alcohol were my problem. Maybe some of you have done this, sat in AA meetings and thought to myself, God, I envy you people, your stupidity. Why have I been cursed with the ability to think and see through this crap? Why can't I just be like you and go, oh, that's wonderful. Remember hearing a guy, it all got down to, I've heard a guy say one time, I don't know where it was, but it stuck in my mind forever. It's the typical Alcoholics Anonymous that I heard. Said, I stayed drunk for 25 years, night and day. One day I walked through that door, and they told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I've just never been so goddamn happy. Learned my first Spanish, adios, baby. And I went up and down, and finally went down in Dallas and didn't come back up. First time I didn't come back up. And my wife and children left me. They took my car back. They took my... And all of a sudden, I was standing with my suitcase full of clothes and my money, and I had no place to turn. And I had burned everybody off. And the guy told me, I'm trying to get someone to drive my car to Los Angeles, about 1,600 miles. Do you know anybody who will do it? I'll get it. So I said, I'll do it. He said, but you're an executive. I said, I'll do it. And the first day I got as far as El Paso, Texas, where I used to live at one time, and got drunk in Mexico. I had a good time. Next day I got to Phoenix, Arizona, and got drunk and lost my car. All my clothes, all my ID. Haven't found it yet. That's a long... And I got in a beef on the street corner with a guy, turned out to be a cop, and he threw me in jail overnight to cool me off, he said. It's about 130 degrees, I didn't cool off. But I woke up about 3 in the morning so sick, oh God, I was sick. And I had to vomit, so I stumbled down to where I thought was the toilet and vomited, and turned out to be a guy's bunk. He wasn't in it, so it wasn't so bad, but... I've done this, I'm sure other people have done this too. I lay down next to it, put my cheek on the cool tile, and then you can sleep. It feels pretty good. Then this guy came back from wherever he was, found his bunk full of vomit and a drunken fool. He said, you damn fool, what the hell? And I'm sure he didn't mean to do it, but he kicked my front teeth out. That was one of the few mornings I was glad that I'd been in psychoanalysis, because I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. But I didn't want to say anything and make trouble. I got out of that place and hit the street, and I discovered something the last few months of my drinking when it really got bad. When you really get, I don't know if they have them here, but in America they have something called AA clubs. And if you really get rotten and smell bad, that's about the only place where you're welcome. Because it's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. Oh, look at my newcomer. Oh. And I found a club in Phoenix, and I bummed $20 off some old lady, and I got to Los Angeles, and through a series of... Some guy gave me some money, and I'd give him a start years ago, and I wound up drinking that up and got in trouble. And one morning, I found myself sleeping in an all-night theater. I don't know if you ever slept in an all-night theater. They're on Skid Row. And people don't go in there to watch the movies. They go in there to go to sleep. They run. They don't run all night. They run until 5 in the morning. And they wake you up. Come on, you bums. Everybody out. And you shuffle out to the street. Right? Didn't know anybody. Rainy and cold. And God, I felt terrible. And I didn't know what I could do. And some guy says, let's go sell a pint of blood. I said, yeah, that's what I'll do. I've never done that before. So he took me up to a blood bank, and we stood in line in the rain, and finally they let us in and took a drop of blood from me and said, you haven't got enough iron in your blood to sell, pal. Sorry. I said, oh, Jesus, I'm so sick. Please. He said, no, I'll tell you what. Down here about 4 blocks, there's something called a midnight mission. Go down there. They'll give you some breakfast. Okay. In the rain, down the street, got to the midnight mission. I need some breakfast. My mouth was bleeding again. He said, you just missed it. We just got done serving. Come back at lunch. You'll have some lunch. I can't wait till lunch. I'm really so sick. Help me. He said, I can't help you, kid. You got to be here at time. You have to come back for lunch. And I grabbed him by the lapel. I said, you don't know how desperate I am. And two guys just walked over and peeled me off him and threw me out the door. I said, don't come back here, you bum. And I stood in the rain outside and I thought, what in hell is wrong? All I ever wanted to do is be a good guy. And I had no idea that was... If some old guy had come up to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. Never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. You can't even get a job washing dishes. Look at you. Your mouth is bleeding down into your shirt, and you're vomiting sick and old, dirty, torn clothes. He says, you lost everything you got. You got no ID. You lost it in that damn car in Phoenix. You got all your money, all your ID, everything. Your little mother up in Wisconsin is no longer permitted to accept phone calls from you, because your stepfather's so tired of watching you work on her emotions, so she'll go down to her tiny little bank account and take out some more dollars and send it to her little boy and hope that'll help him. He'd rather have her think you're dead than the way you are. And he might have said, you've been in and out of AA now for 10 years. And you sit in the meetings and sneer and laugh at them and think how superior you are to these idiots. And now you're dying. And he might have said, why don't you go back to AA one more time and admit you're an alcoholic and see what happens. And if someone had said that to me, if I were willing to tell the truth, I'd say, pal, you don't understand. My case is different. My problem is not alcohol. There's something wrong with me, and I can't find out what it is, and my psychiatrist can. But I know that why reality is too, I can't take it. But nobody said anything to me. And I thought to myself, there must be an AA club here somewhere I can hide out in. So I said, where's the AA club around here? He said, there's nothing downtown. It's Wilshire and Fairfax out the west side. I said, how do you get there? He said, well, you go up this hill to Hill Street and cut over to Wilshire and walk west. And I did that. And I still remember walking that walk. I said, walked. I counted later in my car, 7.5 miles in the rain, sick and my mouth bleeding, cars going by and people pointing and laughing. Look at that creep. I thought, you don't understand. I'm really a nice guy. And I got to this club and the same old crap. Some guy standing there said, welcome home, son. I thought, oh, Jesus. Better than stay out in the rain. But I hung around that club for a couple of days. And first night, I was trying to stay out of sight so they wouldn't anybody try to help me. 12-step me or their stupid nonsense. And everybody had to go to a meeting in the club. But they served cake. So I had about 4 pounds of cake, so I could chew that. Then they had a meeting on gratitude, and I almost threw it up again. Then everybody went home. It was still raining, and just the manager of the club and I were left. And I thought, I better try to be like a newcomer. Maybe he'll like newcomers. So I said, I'm a newcomer, and I have no place to stay. Does AA have any place to help me? He said, you're in luck, kid. Guy named Frank. Another Frank. Left an old 49 Merc in the parking lot last summer. You can sleep in that. It's dry. It doesn't run, but you can sleep in that. You mean to tell me Alcoholics Anonymous answer here is to live in an abandoned car? He says, yeah, good deal, huh? I really like that. That's good. When I slept that old band card in my mouth, started bleeding, got up the next morning, went in the club. I didn't know it was Sunday, but they had a 9 o'clock spiritual meeting. I ate about 4 pounds of cake, and I stood in the meeting until they talked about God, and then I got up and left. Because for a number of reasons, God and I could not stand around be where God was mentioned. Because I knew I was going to go to hell, and I didn't want to think about it. And that night there was another meeting. I sat there, just kept raining, and just like a bad dream. And the manager of the club said, you know, kid, you can come in here on the weekends, but during the week you have to be a member. So starting tomorrow morning, you can't come in. But you're such a mess, I'm going to let you come in, because you'll die in our parking lot, he said. But there are got 3 rules, kid. You can't ask anyone for money. You've got none of your smart remarks. I'd already made a reputation for that. He said, and you got to go to a meeting every night in this club. I thought, I'd almost rather die in the rain than do that. But I did that, and I went to these meetings, and I just hated it. And people would buy me soft food to eat, and I just hated it. And stupid people giving me lectures. And that was my sobriety date. I had no idea. I had no desire to stop drinking. You know, the third tradition over there says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop. I had no desire. To me, stopping drinking was lethal. I had stopped drinking once in my life. I gave it all I had. One of the nights I went to jail overnight for insulting police, I got out in the morning, and my neighbor was waiting for me. That never happened before. I said, listen, it isn't the way it looks. That cop was a fascist. I'm going to get him. I got his badge number. He said, I don't know about that. He said, well, you're out drunk last night. Your little son died and we couldn't find you. And I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy. And that just about killed me. We finally took him up to Wisconsin and buried him in his grandmother's grave. Came back. And I brought up. I gave my hand in his past casket. I said, John Immisland, this will never happen again. I'm going to be a changed man. And I began coming home after work at night instead of stopping for drinks. I began having dinner with my family every night. We'd go take my daughters for rides afterwards. Every meal we had, we said a little prayer for baby John, soul. It was like Easter. Somebody had died, but he died for our sins. And maybe it had been the most peaceful 2 or 3 weeks I'd ever had in my life up to then. And then, one night, somebody snuck into my bedroom and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next day it started. Just a little irritation. Why would they take my son I love so much? And I finally stumbled onto the answer. This damn Norwegian God took my little boy, who never committed a sin in his life, and killed him to punish me. Well, you son of a bitch! I'm done with you. I'll go to hell and you'll get me then, but you won't get me then. Screw you and all your crap. And I never wanted to be around where God was mentioned after that. I'll tell you, it's a funny thing. You know, after all that happened, I still didn't drink. I was drinking for my baby son. And the days got worse and worse. And pretty soon, the job was terrible. And my children, Mary, take your sisters and go to your room, for Christ's sake. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't mean to holler at you. We'll go for a ride tomorrow. I just hated myself. And I needed to drink so bad. But I couldn't drink. It hurt my baby. One day my wife took the kids to Mass. And I parked my car in the garage, hooked up a hose in the exhaust pipe, turned the motor and went to sleep and died. I just was crazy. And a neighbor happened to be sitting in his breakfast nook having a cup of coffee and saw me go in there and heard the motor running. I didn't come out. So he ambled over and found me dead in the car, and he pulled me out, and they beat on my chest and breathed in my mouth and rushed me to the hospital and oxygenated me and examined me for several days and determined I was seriously mentally ill. And they committed me to the state insane asylum for an indefinite period. Nothing on my commitment paper said alcohol. I'd had to drink for some time. And I got to that Texas State Insane Asylum, and I was there till the next year. You know, something like that looks bad on your resume. Where were you this year? Well, I was in the nut house. So that's why a lot of us at our resume it says self-employed during this period. But that's why I didn't want to think to God. That's what happens when I stay sober. My problem is not alcohol. Now, why would I stay sober this time when I was living in an abandoned car, rain, and being treated with contempt by people that a year ago I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn? And because I went to these meetings, and one of these meetings, a couple of the meetings, I saw a guy that I'd seen in the movies. I thought, a movie star. He must have a lot of money. I'll bet he would like to have a new friend. And he seemed kind of dumb. So I moved in on him. He didn't want a new friend, it turned out. By the end of the week, I was doing not very well. And it's Friday, and I was sick and desperate. And God, I got to do something. It's still rainy. I'm going to die. So I really went to the whip. I went to this actor. I said, Bob, I really admire your program. Would you be my sponsor? Gave him my newcomer look. He said, okay, but I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. And I found out later he wasn't a movie star at all. He'd been in 3 movies, had little tiny roles in 3 movies, and I saw 2 of them, so I thought he'd been in a lot of movies. I've been in many more movies than he has ever been in. They said he wasn't a good actor, but he was a good actor because he acted nicely in meetings, and that took a lot of acting for him. Because he turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig of the worst sort. Just, do this, do that. I thought, why am I taking this crap from this idiot? Because he was my only meal ticket out of there. I had to get a score off of this guy. But he was a good man. He tried to help me. And he'd take me to meetings and talk to me. And sometimes when he talked, he'd take me with him. If I was sitting around the club. And I told him, I said, you know, Bob, I want to do one thing. I know you're trying to help me, but you can't really help me because I'm not an alcoholic. My problem is a little different than an alcoholic. My problem is something wrong inside of me that I'm aware of. And if I could only find a way to control it, I'd be all right. But drinking helps me. He said, okay, I understand that, kid. And one night we were at a meeting, and some kid had participated and said, You know, my only problem is alcohol. I don't have the emotional problems that many of you have. It's just when I quit drinking, everything is fine. And after the meeting, Bob nailed him. You shouldn't even be in AA. You have no business being around here. You're taking up our energy and our time and our seats. Get your hell out of here. Wow. And on the way home, I said, Jesus, Bob, kind of hot under the lights today? He said, what are you talking about? I said, how could you tell that kid? He says his problem is alcohol, and he's an alcoholic. So you tell him he shouldn't be here. He says, it shouldn't be. His problem is alcohol. He's got no business being here. I said, Jesus, Bob, you ever read that big book? It talks all about that. He didn't like my attitude. But he gave me an explanation. He said, kid, if a person's problem is alcohol, there's an answer to it. You don't go to AA. You quit drinking. You clean up your act. And when you're offered a drink, you say, no, thank you. I said, that doesn't work, Bob. I've tried that 200 times. He said, that's probably because your problem isn't alcohol, kid. You probably got what I got. The rest of these people are out here. What the hell is that, Bob? Something that sounds like alcohol, but it isn't. It's something called alcoholism. I said, oh, Jesus, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than hell. He said, listen. And he gave me about an hour and a half harangue, most of which I was able to blot out before I went insane. But some of it got through, and much to my surprise, looking back, it began to change my life. And it was an explanation I'd never heard before. And if you're new, maybe you've never heard it. He said, kid, an alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and shaping up. However, in this strange thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye as an alcohol problem, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding thing called alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful it's unbearable. I said, Jesus, Bob, I've never heard you say that before. They all say getting sober makes it better. I said, maybe temporarily, maybe for a couple of days, but it doesn't work. I said, then why do these alcoholics drink all the time when they know it's about eating going to get them crazy? He said, they don't drink is going to get them crazy, kid. You don't seem to know much. You say you've been around 8, 10 years. You don't know a hell of a lot. And he had a glass of Coke in his hand. He said, here's what an alcoholic. You know what an alcoholic is? Yes. He says, it's a person who gets an unnatural reaction to alcohol. I said, yes, I've heard him talk about it. It sets up the phenomenon of craving, and then you drink and drink and drink and drink till you go crazy or die. Nah, that's podium talk. I'll tell you why alcoholics drink, kid. If this were Jack Daniels, it almost instantly alters my perception of reality. It almost instantly alters my relationship to the people around me. It almost instantly makes me taller and more self-contained inside, and them smaller and less threatening to me. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? He said, because it is not really happening, you moron. Oh, I said, you mean to tell me that other people who drink don't get that effect? He said, no. Less than 10% of people who drink alcohol get that effect. It has to do something special for you. Unless it does something special for you, it'll never do anything to you. I said, my God, it's hard to believe. He said, you say you've been in therapy for all these years. Do you know any therapy in the world that works as good as alcohol? Maybe take some dummy, lost everything, going to commit suicide. My family's left me in my job. I can't get another job. I've drunk everything away. Stop and get a couple of going away drinks. Give me another one. And 10 minutes later, you're down the bar saying, you with anyone, Granny? It just changes things. I said, to quote Peter, "Jesus, Bob." I said, "Jesus, I never knew that." I said, "But there's a guy at the meeting tonight who said he'd been sober and got drunk again. Why would he get drunk again if it's all so good doing that?" He said, "That's the other part of the disease, kid." And he had a theory that I thought sounded stupid then, but I heard it taped years later, and I thought, God, that's so true. He said, when people are born, and you grow up and you're raised, it's a kind of a battle to become a mature individual. It's not easy being young. People don't listen to your crap, and people don't pay attention to you. And every time you fall in love, it breaks your heart, and you're supposed to solve problems you can't solve, and resolve conflicts that are difficult, and it's just not easy being young. But if you can get through all this crap and become a mature individual, you can lead a good life. You almost instinctively know how to hold a job. You get along with your employees, fellow employees. If you're married, you get along with your mate. You have some clue on how to be a good parent. You get along with the neighbors. Go on square vacations with your kids and enjoy it. He said, "This is wonderful." He said, "But this almost never happens to alcoholics." I said, "Why not, Bob?" He said, "Because when we've discovered along the way, when we have a very painful problem we have to find an answer to, or a conflict we have to resolve, and we can't find an answer, we have discovered you can drink them away." Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. Hey, Mr. Carlson, take your job and shove it up your nose. And they all really work. I can tell you that from experience. But the problem is, every time they work, he said, leaves almost an invisible little cold steel ball somewhere in your psyche. And they build up. And the day comes, eventually drinking gets to be a problem. And all of us at one time or another say, "I think I'm going to quit. I'm going to quit. I'm sick of taking all this crap from people. I'm not going to put up with this. I'm going to quit. And I'll just come home from work and be a good guy and get up early in the morning, be to work early and do my work." And never once know that for people like me, and I presume like you, it is impossible. Why? Because each of those little steel balls are unresolved childish emotions. And sooner or later, someone will trigger them. Someone will hurt your feelings. Someone will say something bad about you that you'll hear about. Someone will treat you with a little contempt. And it starts. And especially in a work situation. And if you're doing good, well, you're jealous puke. And after a while, you notice, his friends are probably in on it too. They're bad-mouthing me. And little by little, it gets very unpleasant. I hate to go to work in the morning with those dirty bastards. And after a while, you get so you can lie awake at night thinking about them. And scientists who study alcoholics like us say, we can get to a point. Now, here's so ironic. People like us can get to a point where we literally must drink to preserve our sanity. Isn't that ironic? The same stuff that makes us crazy. And pretty soon I'll drink. And that starts the pilot light. And pretty soon it's, boom. Pretty soon I'm out of a job again. People say, "Gee, Clancy, you had such a great job. What happened?" "Oh, there were a bunch of phonies. I didn't like them. I'll get a better job." And I would. And Bob explained all this to me out of my life. I said, "Jesus, Bob, I've never heard anybody. That's the story of my life for the last 10 years and almost pretty closely. Do good, do bad, blow up, do bad, just on one thing after another, bad breaks and misunderstandings." He said, "There's a name for people like you, kid." I thought, oh, what could that be? Because he swore a lot. I said, "What could that be, Bob?" He said, "You're an alcoholic." I said, "My God. I thought alcoholics were people whose problem was alcohol." He said, "No, big misconception, kid. Alcoholics are people whose answer is alcohol." I said, "My God, I never realized that." I said, why doesn't AA describe it the way you do, instead of this phony allergy of the body, obsession of the mind, crap, pseudo-psychiatric nonsense? He said, "They do, kid. Look over there on the wall. All they ask you is this. You have to admit you're having a problem with alcohol. And then there's a dash, which in the English language means end of thought, beginning of new thought. And you must also admit you're having a problem without alcohol. And if either one of those things weren't there, you wouldn't be here. If you could drink, you'd be out drinking. If you could stay sober, you'd be home staying sober. When you can't do either, you get driven into rooms like this, then you sit there and watch your head try to find ways to prove you're different so you can get the hell out of here and get a drink. I said, Jesus, Bob. That was in December 1958, long time ago. I was 6 weeks sober. And that became my sobriety date, my original sobriety, October 31st, 1958. So I just celebrated 50 years last October. I hope we've ever got the pension, but I heard that. And I just couldn't believe it. And that, I took the premise that I was an alcoholic, and I tried to listen differently to people, and listen to people who talked about living problems rather than drinking. And I just fit in like a. There's sometimes I didn't want to stay, but of course Bill Wilson with a spiritual experience. 6 months after he had a spiritual experience, he was thinking about drinking in Akron, Ohio. You know, it doesn't mean you're never going to think about drinking again, but you got something to believe in. And the problem came after that. I'll get this done quickly. I know many of you have several miles to go to get home. He said, well, it's about time to work on the steps. And as I say, the first three steps don't apply to me. The first step does now. But I can't return to God. I mean, I can't return to God. I said, Bob, I can't return to God. He said, nothing today says you got to return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself, Bob? Does that fool the others? You know what the hell they're talking about. He said, it doesn't say that either. Why don't you read the damn step? It says you come to believe in something. Nothing there ever asks you in AA to return to anything because we're coming out of sick perceptions. He said, you got to try to come to believe in something. Can't you come to believe in a loving God? No, I can't. He said, do you like AA? I said, well, a little bit more, but not much. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, of course you are, Bob. He said, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that. I could accept that because he couldn't send me to hell. He tried, but he couldn't. But think about that step is this if you're new and having problems. We ask you to come to believe that there's a power here. You don't have to know what it is or define it. That maybe comes later down the road somewhere. All you have to believe, there must be a power here because this room is full of people who have felt the way you feel and they're staying sober. There's some power here. Just come to believe there's a power here. That's not hard to believe. I remember saying to Bob, I don't believe there's a power greater than myself in the world. He says, go out under this streetlight tonight and take off your clothes. You'll see a power greater than yourself in a black and white car. He says, the world is full of powers greater than you are, you punk. I said, oh. But the question in the second step is, what's the power going to do? Restore me to sanity. What the hell is sanity? You can read 10 books on mental health. You get 10 different definitions of sanity. Who knows? But oddly enough, insanity is easy to define. When the human brain is under sufficient intense conflict that in order to maintain its neural integrity, it will go to the last gasp defense. It will change its perception of reality. That is called psychosis. And sometimes it's the whole world. It's easy to spot and they put you away. Sometimes it's just a little area. And it has to be triggered somewhere. You see it once on the paper. God, I lived next door to that guy for 10 years. He came home one night, nice guy, took a rifle, killed his wife, killed all his kids. Why would he do that? Something triggered that psychosis. Psychosis is an irremediable thing, as a rule. He says, yeah, I was psychotic. No, I'm not. I was like, if you become truly psychotic, you stay that way, as a rule. We become intensely neurotic and painful, but it's not psychotic. But as he explained to me, alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that wonderful? Some of us come here psychotic. but we don't become psychotic. Why not? Why would not alcoholics, of all these goofy, emotional, crazy people, why would they become psychotic? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, I drink alcohol. And the effect of alcohol is to alter my perception of reality. Although I never guessed it, I have the power to induce temporary psychosis. And so do you. And then the next day you're back to normal again and you have to fight it again. But so maybe try that application of the second step. Come to realize that these steps mean what they say. We do not need long meetings holding interpretations of what they really mean. They mean what they say. You and I have to come to believe there's a power here that will make it unnecessary for me to drink alcohol. Hard to believe. Where could it be? But that's what you have to come to believe. And then the third and last step in that trilogy that I found so offensive, you're going to turn your will and your life over to God. And I couldn't do that. I told Bob, I can't do that. We've got to try somehow. But I wrestled with that for a while, and I found a solution, which sometimes people laugh at, but it was not funny at all. I decided to rewrite the third step to read, "I will try to do what Bob says." And that saved my life. I found myself taking actions that I would never take at all. I remember standing at the Brentwood meeting when I was new. He said, "See that woman over there?" I said, "Yes, I see her, old Happy Austin bag." He said, "I want you to apologize to her." I said, "Why?" "Someone told me that Monday night at the club you called her a bitch." "She is a bitch." "Why do you think she's a bitch?" "She told her new girl to stay away from me." "Well, she's right. You apologize." I can't think of a person in the world telling me that I wouldn't have said, "To hell with you. Go over there and abase myself in front of that old bag. All she ever does is bad mouth me, hurts me as much as she can. She hates me. She wishes I were dead. I'd rather die than go over and apologize to that old bag." But someone who I believed knew how I felt, and I just tried to take a vow that I would do what he said, it just about killed me. I went, "Sorry I called you a bitch." "You bitch." He got me to not quit a job I was going to quit. He got me to go to meetings where I thought they were condescending to me. And little by little, my life changed. The day I was going to commit suicide, he had me write an inventory. I swore, I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. Why do I want to take it with an out-of-work actor? What's he going to say? Cut. You know, nothing. But he took me for... I was so upset that day, I wrote things I never told anybody in the world. Certainly not my psychiatrist. People asked me later, "Why don't you tell your psychiatrist these things?" "Because when you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why you don't tell him." I don't want some little wussy to say to me, "You did what, sir? Get out of my office. But first wash that chair, will you?" Yeah. But I wrote, and then he had me take it in his car, and he drove me to Oxnard, 40 miles away, and gave me a flashlight and had me read it. And, oh, God, no big things, but what kind of little, tiddly, dirty, rotten, stinking, pukey... I thought, he's going to make me walk back from Oxnard 40 miles. I said, "Well, that's all, Bob." He said, "Are you finished now?" "Yes, I am." He leaned over and said, "That's the best thing you did since you got sober, kid." And I said, "Thought it was." And I made amends to people I hated. Did a lot of things. The only therapy I've had since 1950 is Alcoholics Anonymous. But my life changed little by little. Slowly. And it hasn't always been peachy keen. But after a while, I got a little job that I held. I got another little job that I did quite well on. I got, by the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for a big medical corporation. I went to work there without front teeth. I had learned to carry my lip like that. And I wrote something that they just loved. But then I heard a guy say, "That guy doesn't even have any front teeth." There it starts again. They're going to start on me. I might as well pop this guy and quit, you know, just boom, and quit. But I thought, if I do that, I'll have to explain it to the damn Bob. So I called him up and said, this guy's putting me down, Bob. He's laughing at me. I got, he said, why would he say that? I don't know, Bob, to hurt me. He said, ask him why he said it. I said, are you crazy? I know why he said it. He's trying to hurt me. He said, ask him why he said it. So I got this guy aside. I said, I understand you think it's kind of funny. I don't have any front teeth. He said, oh, no. Just the opposite. I was telling someone, you got secondhand clothes on. Belonged to somebody else before it belonged to you, obviously. They don't quite fit. And you got no front teeth. And you look pretty bad. And yet you write so well. So something bad must have happened to you along the way. And you're making a comeback, he said. I'll tell you. My hat's off to you. I wish you well. Really proud. And I said, oh. But I got to be director of advertising that big medical corporation. I was 7 years old. We were talking on the way over tonight. I became another guy, and I created the number one hard rock station in America, something called Voss Radio. That young man used to hear it, and that's why he's weird. And when I was 10 years sober, I was marketing director for a publishing firm downtown Los Angeles. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director and doing very well. Things were going my way. Got my kids back. They were all grown up. Had another little son. Thank God he grew up. And it was really good. Three of my daughters, in fact, just turned 20 this year in AA. My son, who I was so pleased to have a son again, he became the apple of my eye. Of course, he became the captain of his high school football team. I've flown back from a lot of places in the world to run the 10-yard chains for his football games. And he went away to college, became a computer wizard. He came home, got a great job. He designed these computer games that cost so much, and he became an alcoholic. And it just about kills me. I sponsor people all over the world. I sponsor some people in this crowd tonight. I sponsor people in a lot of places. And I have a good group of people. And I can't help my own son. But I know that's the nature of alcoholism. Nobody can help their own son. They can't help your own father. You can't help. I guess the reason is that it isn't AA talking. It was just the old man with more of his crap somehow. And he's lost his wife. Now she's gone. And his job is teetering. And I haven't talked to him for months. Maybe talked to him once every 3 or 4 months. I said to his wife, I said, Diana, why is Clancy, his name is Clancy, is he angry at me? I love him so much, and he just won't talk to me. She said, oh, no, he loves you very much, but he never wants to talk to you when he has alcohol in his breath, and he always has alcohol in his breath. So I pray for him every night. I hope he's going to be all right. But those things happen. Only one of my daughters has turned out bad. She became a judge. She came up at Christmas a few years ago. She said, Daddy, remember when little girls used to scream at us and send us to our room? I said, sure, honey, but you understand why. She says, of course I do. But when you come to Albuquerque, New Mexico, I'm going to send you to a little room. I'm not going to Albuquerque, New Mexico. But it turns out the funny thing that Alcoholics Anonymous is so simple. And the last thing I want to tell you about, it turns out, if you're new wondering, how dry can I get? How dry is this old fool up there 50 years sober? You know, he's about to burst into flame. Just being dry is not the goal here. You get as dry at 30 days as you'll ever be in your life. The purpose of AA turned out, although I never would have guessed it in 1,000 years, is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. To change my perception of reality, to make a softer and better place. To change my relationship to people around me so I live easily amongst people. To make me taller and more self-contained so I'm not attacked by every passing glance or tone of. And it seems that, you know, it doesn't come all at once. It comes in bits and spurts. You may get a little bit in your first 30 days, you know. What was that feeling I had? I felt good there for a moment. What does this mean? Yeah. But little by little. By the time I was 15 years sober, I had things going my way, and I really felt good. And I felt too good, and Mother Nature took care of me. One day I found myself leaving my job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 35 years I've been the managing director of the Skid Row Mission that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why would you give up your great career to run that mission? And there's no good answer to that. Well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. And when I get back to Los Angeles, I'll do something that very few of you will do. Because I live in a big house by the ocean, nice place. In fact, today and Saturday, there's 150 AAs in my backyard playing volleyball and softball and having fun because I'm not there. But Monday morning, I'll get up and I'll get in my car and go through Beverly Hills and go down to this ravaged area, dreadful area, people dying all over, and take my morning walk around the mission, seeing people little by little dying around me, step over the bodies of dying men, women, and children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction and abandonment and insanity, and spend the day in with the staff of the Midnight Mission trying to find ways to get these poor bastards to acknowledge they got a problem, to do something for God's sake, instead of just lay there and die. And then I go home and have dinner with my grandson and go to a meeting. Big deal. Doesn't sound like much, but it's a great deal. Because the greatest piece of information I've gotten here, you know, if you're kind of new, there's a lot of stuff. Now, tomorrow there's a convention meeting. And I'm going to talk again, but I'm going to talk about something interesting tomorrow. Not me. But there's a lot of books and tapes and CDs and conventions and all sorts of things. Boy, where's AA in all this? It's all part of AA, like your ears and legs are part of an elephant. But what AA really is, what you learn after a while, but Alcoholics Anonymous, the germ of AA is the same as it was in 1935. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of difference at least enough so that he would begin to take actions he does not yet believe in. And when that moment comes, the miracle starts. Thank you.
Thank you, Clancy. Thank you. And I think I speak on behalf of every single individual here tonight to give you a huge thank you. It was truly inspirational, truly inspirational. And I'm up here with my hanky. You're here in AA when you first arrive. Good news is you get your emotions back, and the bad news is you get your emotions back. But a lot of the tears tonight have been with laughter and fellowship, and I'm extremely grateful to have been here to hear your message tonight, Clancy. Thank you. Thanks for everybody for coming. Safe journey to everybody tonight. And please don't forget, the next event is in Dameron in December. And I think with that... Sorry? Is that right? It was December on the... Anyway, so will you please help me close this event tonight with our serenity prayer? And I don't know, should we stand and hold our hands? Yes. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know that I keep coming back. It works if you work it.